Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, along with Josh Rogers. Welcome to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange. This hour, Democratic presidential candidate and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley is with us. O'Malley served two terms as his state's chief executive from 2006 to 2014. Before that, he was mayor of Baltimore for 8 years, starting in 1999. This weekend, O'Malley participated in New Hampshire's Democratic debate on Saturday and then spent time campaigning here in the state. But thus far, the former governor has had a hard time getting as much attention from New Hampshire voters as his two rivals for the nomination, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. For the next 40 minutes, we're sitting down with Governor Martin O'Malley, and in addition to taking questions from me and Josh Rogers, we'll hear from our live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. They'll be submitting questions as well. And Josh Rogers, let's begin with you.
All right. Good morning, Governor. This morning, students in New Hampshire's second largest city, some 70,000 students, aren't in school because of what officials have called a specific threat of violence. We don't know what that threat is yet, but in general, it seems fair to say that the state and country are on edge. Are there policies you think this country needs or that a president might enact that at a minimum might make people feel safer?
Josh, I am the only candidate in this race who is a post-9/11 mayor and a post-9/11 governor. What that means is that I uniquely understand that when events like San Bernardino happen and people dial 911, it's a first responder response. So I don't know the ins and outs of why Nashua school districts are closed, but I do know this. We've entered into a whole new era of conflict, and many of us might have hoped that 9/11 was a one-off sort of event and it was put to rest when justice was brought to bin Laden. But this threat will change. It will morph. It will evolve. And we need to adapt more quickly in front of it. And what I have found works is to make sure that the people in your local government and state government understand that every day we need to be working to make our cities, our states more resilient, more prepared, and more capable of sharing information. And that means also speaking directly to the public about threats as they emerge and being honest about what we know, about what we don't know, and evolving more quickly than this threat evolves so we can stay ahead of it. So what does that mean? That means that we need to do a better job within the homeland of sharing information, analysis, intelligence, not just within governments but across governments. It means we should have interoperable communications with all our first responders, biosurveillance systems. But all of these are about the best metaphor I can come up with in this new era of conflict is that your own body's immune system is able to protect your body from bad germs in the world, not because it outnumbers them, but because it's better connected and it's more intelligent and it can react more quickly. And that's what we need. That's the concept, I believe, that we need to give life to here in the homeland. I was selected year in and year out by my colleagues in the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National Association of Governors, by Democrats and Republicans alike, to be their leader every year, one of two. Every year on homeland security and preparedness. So I bring something to this conversation. I'd be glad to go deeper on any of these various issues if you like.
Well, one thing you've also talked about is the need to do a better job controlling guns. It's something that you pointed to in the debate on Saturday night as well. You've said that you have a goal of reducing gun deaths by half within 10 years. How do you do that?
In my own state, after the after the attacks in Connecticut and all of those kids were slaughtered in their classroom, I brought my state together to pass comprehensive gun safety legislation, the elements of which were a ban on combat assault weapon sales and also requiring licensing and background checks. We had previously closed the gun show loophole, and also a ban on magazines with more than 10 rounds in it. It was hard to get it passed. We never saw more opposition than we saw from the National Rifle Association, and their members supported mailing lists. But we held counter rallies of our own. We organized and we got it done, and not a single hunter ever lost their hunting privilege. I've never met a self-respecting hunter that needed an AR-15 to down a deer. And we need to take common sense measures at the national level. Look, when ISIL is doing training videos that tell their would-be lone wolves, like that couple in San Bernardino, that the easiest way to get a combat assault weapon in the United States is to go to a gun show, that should tell us, without the need for Homeland Security experts, that should tell us that we have a huge gap in our vulnerability and we need to close it.
I mean, obviously President Obama has tried to move on guns, post-Newtown. How would you be more effective? Obviously, it hasn't been successful for him.
Right. Every president's different. Every Congress is different. And on that last point, thank goodness every Congress can be different. We vote and elect a new Congress every 2 years. I think it's very difficult to claim a mandate for change when you don't campaign on the need for that change. So I believe that how you campaign determines how you govern. I've made one of our 15 goals for moving our country forward, cutting gun deaths in half. And so I intend to campaign on it. As an executive, I have also found that oftentimes taking executive action can kind of prime the pump and can develop a broader public consensus. And there's a few things the president can do today as an by way of executive orders, like declaring that we will no longer, as the biggest purchaser of weapons in the United States, the U.S. government, we will no longer purchase weapons unless they're from manufacturers that use the highest and best safety technology, that we will actually put forward the regulations that close the huge gaps and waivers that are out there that allow people to buy these armor-piercing so-called cop-killing bullets. These are things that can be done by executive order, and there are others as well with regard to taking guns out of the hands of domestic abusers. Many times we actually do thwart gun sales because of the background checks that are already on the book, and yet the follow-up to that is slim to none between our federal government, state police, and local police. That can be changed by way of executive order. And I also intend to be relentless. Many of the things that we got done in my own state, whether it was passing marriage equality, repealing the death penalty, passing the DREAM Act, many of these things took several attempts before we accomplished them. But as an effective executive, I learned never to give up and not to listen to the advice of pollsters that say that to fail is bad for you politically. I just see it as a step on the road to success.
I mean, in terms of being relentless, some people, real advocates of gun control, have proposed that the United States had to look at a mandatory buyback, for instance, as was instituted in Australia. Obviously, that's not popular with the Second Amendment lobby. I heard this issue raised at a Hillary Clinton event in Keene, and the former Secretary of State said she'd be willing to look in a buyback program. I haven't heard much about that since. Where would you be on something like that?
Yeah, I think we should all be willing to look at things differently and be open to new ideas consistent with our own Constitution. We've done – when I was mayor of Baltimore, we did some gun buybacks. In fact, I was talking to a woman the other night who was from Australia. I didn't realize that it was mandatory there. But I think we should be open to new approaches and do everything we can. We have the worst problem of any country in the developed world when it comes to the numbers of our citizens we bury from guns and gun violence.
Governor O'Malley, I'd like to ask you about your record in Baltimore since you mentioned it, and especially your time in Baltimore, but also as governor. You've often touted your record on crime in Baltimore, and there were large reductions in crime during your tenure. We've heard about that.
And overdose deaths, which is the other half of the story that's not often told. We probably saved more lives by increasing drug treatment and reducing overdose deaths during those 10 years, even than neighbors and police saved by reducing homicides.
Well, and that's a big issue in this campaign, too, heroin overdoses, and maybe we'll get to that. But I did want to ask you about the tactics of zero tolerance, widespread arrests, which today, Governor O'Malley, being criticized as heavy-handed, too much. How do you feel about that criticism in this era now when we're worried about police brutality, mass incarceration, and so forth?
I believe that we have to constantly be searching for the things that work and the things that don't work to save lives and to redeem lives. And that's particularly important in our country where issues of crime and law enforcement have been intertwined with our legacy of slavery, discrimination, and racial injustice. So throughout my service to the people of our city and our state, I've been on a constant search for the things that work and the things that do not. It's hard to describe if you didn't live there at the time, where Baltimore was in 1999. But we had allowed ourselves to become the most violent, the most addicted, and the most abandoned city in America because of ever-rising drug addiction, drug overdose deaths, and a sort of 24/7 drug dealer occupation that we allowed to take place over the poorest neighborhoods of our city.
So does that justify some of the tactics that have so upset members of the African-American community?
No, there's no justification for brutality. There's no justification for excessive force. There's no justification for lethal force. And I drove all of those things down as mayor. Let me say that one more time. I drove all of those things down as mayor. You might understand, I think you do, that at the time, during that campaign, to run for mayor as a white man in a majority African-American city, there was never a single day when we were not during the campaign discussing these issues of how we improve policing and how we improve how we police the police. I recruited to the highest levels ever by the time I left the most diverse police force in Baltimore history. I put in place not only a civilian review board, but I gave the civilian review board in the budget its own detectives so they could investigate every case fully. And three of the lowest years of fatal police-involved shootings on record in Baltimore were achieved while I was mayor. If I had not been improving the responsiveness of the police, because at the time, the great injustice that people talked about in that campaign, where, by the way, I won every single district, including the two of my opponents, their two districts, which were the hardest hit by crime. Both of my opponents were African-American city council people representing almost 100% African-American districts. The biggest complaint we heard was that when you call for police service in Baltimore in those days from a wealthier neighborhood, black or white, the police always come and they always get out of the car. But when you call from a poor neighborhood, most of which were black, they hardly ever come. And when they do, they never get out of the car. But if we had not done the things I promised in that campaign, by the way, greatly increasing drug treatment, intervening earlier in the lives of young people because we had appalling numbers of our kids that we were putting in body bags, and improving police response and how we police the police, had I not done all those things, I would not have been reelected 4 years later with 88% of the vote by my people, nor would I have enjoyed such overwhelming support in African-American neighborhoods of Baltimore City when I ran two times for governor. And there was a lot of talk at the time.
Yeah. Sure. When you announced for president, there were people went to Baltimore, people went to Maryland and talked to leaders in the African-American community. And more than one of them said, Governor O'Malley, that your policies bred mistrust in African-American communities, that it was heavy-handed. The NAACP and the ACLU ended up suing the city a couple years after you left office, but over policies that started under you. In the debate Saturday night, you said on this question, we've learned so much. What have you learned, Governor O'Malley, that would inform you as president? Again, given your experience, I understand you justifying what you did, and I understand it was a tough time. But you got to acknowledge there are some people now saying, whoa, this guy went overboard.
No, Donna, don't misunderstand me. Every day there were people who accused me of engaging in unfair policing tactics.
So what have you learned that you would apply as president?
Every day. What I've learned is this. I mean, during the course of my time as governor and as mayor, we were on a search every single day. I have put forward a plan, a new agenda for criminal justice reform in our country. I'm the only candidate on either stage who can claim, to, as governor, to have reduced violent crime to 30-year lows and also to have reduced our incarceration rate to 20-year lows. I restored voting rights to 52,000 people who had felony convictions. I decriminalized the possession of marijuana. I reduced our recidivism rate by, I believe, the biggest percentage of any of the 50 states during the last 8 years by doing things that work on reentry programs, on drug treatment. And it took us three tries, but I repealed the death penalty.
So those are things you would do as president, given your experience in Maryland
and
Baltimore.
Yes, and some other things I've suggested is this. This is what I did during my time as mayor on the issues of policing and policing the police. We instituted 100 reverse integrity stings a year. You know, so an integrity sting would be where you have an undercover officer call in a complaint on a drug corner as if they're on a corner, you know, plagued by drug dealing. And you see how the police officer responds. If the officer responds and approaches another person on that corner who does not match the description and then plant drugs on him, that would be a pretty egregious case of an integrity sting that failed or from the sting's standpoint succeeded in what it set out to
do. How do police feel about those integrity stings?
I've never been endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police. But the vast majority of police officers and their spouses understand that the greatest protection for police is the community trust and the good people who will have those officers' backs so long as they act professionally and courteously.
Governor Miller, let me jump in and remind everyone that you're listening to a special first-in-the-nation primary forum on The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers, and our guest is former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, a Democratic presidential candidate. We also have a live audience with us from the Concord Young Professionals Network, and I'd like to go to that audience now. And good morning. Thanks for being here. Please give us your name and ask your question.
Good morning, Governor. My name's Matt. I'm a member of the Concord Young Professionals Network. Investment in the nation's aging infrastructure is critically important for public safety and economic growth. Earlier this month, Congress passed a five-year, $300 billion transportation bill. Here in New Hampshire, we will depend on federal funding to support the widening of Interstate 93 through Concord and hopefully passenger rail service from Boston to the southern part of the state.
Hear, hear.
Two-part question for you. First part, is the bill passed by Congress sufficient to meet the nation's infrastructure needs? And if not, how would you have improved this piece of legislation?
Thank you so much, Matt. Go ahead, Governor O'Malley.
Yeah, it's probably not sufficient. But it's a step forward. And whenever this particular Congress can do something that moves us forward rather than back, I think all of us should applaud. So I think it's a step forward. Look, this is what we did when I was governor. It took me three attempts, but we eventually modernized our gas tax. It hadn't been raised since 1992. It was a flat tax, probably no tax more unpopular in the American psyche than the gas tax. But after raising it and indexing it to inflation, price of a gallon of gas actually dropped by 50 cents, which was fortunate for those who had to run, I suppose. But no great people ever gave their children a future with more opportunity by making their country weaker. And one of the components of our formula of actions to include more people more fully in the economic life of our country is that we do make certain investments that we can only make together, like the investments we make in infrastructure. And you underscored the need for investments in rail. As governor, I made big investments in our own commuter rail system. And I think you guys have a tremendous opportunity here in New Hampshire to strengthen that rail connection with Boston.
Well, the question always is, who will pay for it? It's very expensive. New Hampshire's rural and suburban, so it's not like Maryland where it's densely populated and you've got that guaranteed population center that might jump on the train.
Yeah. You know what? It wasn't terribly dissimilar from Maryland. And all of those same arguments, Donna, you so succinctly articulated, were the same arguments that were made in Maryland. But we were able to bring people together because in the investments we made sure that there was something there for everyone. So we did make investments in some of the road infrastructure that the rural areas needed, but we also made the rail investments as well. And that was the ethic of our One Maryland, that we're all in this together. We have to help each other, and if we do, we can succeed.
All right. Well, thank you again for that question. And coming up, more with Democratic presidential candidate Martin O'Malley. This is a First in the Nation primary forum on The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Today, The Exchange, it's a special First in the Nation primary forum. Our guest this hour is former Maryland governor and Baltimore mayor Martin O'Malley, a Democratic presidential candidate. We're also joined by a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
Governor, let's talk about foreign policy and national security. At the debate on Saturday, you said the country hasn't invested in intelligence enough, among other things. Let's take a listen.
I believe that what's happened here is that the president had us on the right course, but it's a lack of battle tempo. We have to increase the battle tempo. We have to bring a modern way of getting things done and forcing the sharing of information and do a much better job of acting on it in order to prevent these sorts of attacks in the future.
So, Governor, my question is this. What specifically do you mean by battle tempo, and you know, how encompassing is that?
This is what I mean by that. I mean that government traditionally has been government by annual inputs. And the new way of governing that you see coming up from cities across the United States is government by outputs. Leadership under the old way of governing was that leaders would sit high atop big hierarchies, big bureaucracies of command and control, and things got done on the basis of because I said so. But oftentimes, it would take a very long time for the things to get done through the chain of command. In the modern era, where people are getting information at the same time that their government is, the place for the leader to be is in the center of that emerging truth, convening circles of collaboration, of information sharing, asking every week, are we doing better this week than we were doing last week? And so what I mean by a battle tempo and a new way of governing is that we need to pull people together, not around episodes, not around crises, not around annual budgets. That term battle tempo is one that I think military people use more than we use in civilian life. But I also believe, I know, that we've not made the investments in the human intelligence, both of the overt type, you know, diplomatic and business, but also of the covert type in this troubled area of the world. So we find ourselves playing the playbooks from the Cold War of toppling regimes without yet having any idea what happens next or who the emerging leaders are. So this is a transition that we're going through as a country in this new era of conflict, and I believe our people are looking for that sense of purpose and the framework that allows us to be successful in this world without becoming entangled and bogged down in long wars of occupation.
Well, on the intelligence gathering front, there's been a bunch of talk after San Bernardino about whether U.S. tech companies should be forced to help the government with encrypted communications. What do you think about that?
I think that there's a lot of collaboration that needs to happen around this. I believe that some of the principles that we have as a people that our government should have to get a warrant before they tap our phones or go into and break the sanctity of the mail. I think those principles still apply. And in terms of encryption technologies, we have to find a way to both safeguard people's privacy, but also allow our government, when they have probable cause and when they do have a warrant, to be able to defend us here in the homeland from those that would seek to take American lives.
And how far would you go as president to engage the U.S. in fighting ISIS and terrorism overseas? Or, you know, how does your approach differ from your rivals? You've said that Hillary Clinton, for instance, is always quick for military intervention and that not every fight is our fight. How do you determine which fights are ours and which aren't?
I believe that you do it according to our national interests. When you have let me talk a little bit about ISIL and how I see it anyway. And when the others are on the show, I'm sure they'll probably have different views. I look at this fight against ISIL on three planes. There has now been created a vacuum in Syria and also parts of Iraq that has allowed a new safe haven to crop up. that allows this latest iteration of global terror to launch attacks on the West. We have seen the downed airliner. We have seen the attacks in Paris. We've seen the attacks in Beirut, and now the couple in San Bernardino. So I believe our role there is a special ops role. I support the president in deploying more special ops troops. I believe our role there is close combat or close air support. I do not believe that putting big American divisions on the ground is a good tactic or a good strategy. We should learn from that and our experience there. And in terms of combating ISIS here in the homeland, we need better preparedness, better information sharing, better intelligence gathering. We need to invest in those sorts of things here. You know, we've cut by 2/3 Homeland Security grants that used to go to states and local governments since the attacks of September 11th.
I mean, as far as fighting ISIS overseas, Senator Sanders has said that this needs to be something led by my Muslim countries, as he put it. You know, a lot of these countries and allies in the region have competing interests. They don't often get along. How would you bring them together?
Yeah, that's the I believe that this challenge is going to require a level of diplomatic engagement and an increased diplomatic tempo as well. Part of the what we've seen here with is the Sunni Shia split. And with the destabilization of Iraq and then the destabilization of Syria, we need to assemble a coalition. And it won't be easy. None of this is easy. I'm sure all of us can hear the frustration in the president's voice as well.
How would you be more effective, Governor O'Malley? I'm sure President Obama and Secretary Kerry have been trying like the dickens to bring these coalitions that everybody keeps talking about together. So why would you do a better job at that?
I believe that I have the ability to increase the battle tempo here and to increase the diplomatic pressure because I have a record of success as an executive. And look, none of this is easy. We're all choosing among the candidates running for president from human beings that all have a different mix of talents and a different mix and a different skill set. But of the three of us that are competing for the office for our party's nomination, I believe that I have the best chance of bringing people together because I don't have one foot caught in the Cold War like Hillary Clinton does. I don't have a proven track record of failing to anticipate the second and third consequences of toppling regimes. I don't have a lust and a glee for regime toppling. I understand that this world has changed and that we need to act in coalition and that we need to bring people together and that we need to break ourselves out of the old Cold War mentality that there are some people on our side all the time and some people against us all the time. That's not the way the real world works.
Okay. Well, so much more to talk about. And I do want to bring our audience back in. So go ahead. Thank you for turning out. And please ask your question.
Hi, Governor. I'm Brennan Barnard. I'm the Director of College Counseling at the Derryfield School down in Manchester. And, you know, so much of the conversation around college education has focused on affordability, as it certainly should. Experience tells me that beyond finances, college enrollment is dependent upon a mentor or concerned adult in a student's life. How do you propose to expand to quality the access to quality college counseling?
You ended up at a different place on that question than I thought you were going. It's a shame that in school budgets that the first things that seem to get cut by school boards right after art and music are counselors. And so I think we need to do a much better job of lifting up the best practices in our country and underscoring just how important those high school counselors are to kids, especially the earlier the better. I also think that we have an opportunity to reform our high school education, and in particular that fourth year of high school. Career and technical education and restoring that to our schools. I mean, my hope would be that over our not too distant horizon, we get to a point where when our kids graduate from high school, they have not only a diploma that means something, but they also have a certificate and a skill that's actually in demand. Perhaps in some economies, woodworking is important, but in this economy, coding is probably a much more marketable skill in a lot of parts of our nation, as well as plumbing and HVAC and those other very needed things. And then the third piece would be to expand our programs that allow for early access to college credit so that more and more of our kids graduate with up to a year of college credit by the time they're out of high school that can transfer up. But you do make a very important point that a lot of the progress that we need to make is about restoring connections that have been broken, and those counselors are really critically important connectors to both the information and the pathways that kids and families need to make the best decisions of how to get that college degree without necessarily saddling themselves with a lifetime of debt.
Well, Brennan, thank you for the question. And Josh Rogers, back to you.
Can I say that also my website is martinomalley.com? And that I have put forward a plan to move us to debt-free college within the next 5 years. And I'm the only candidate seeking the presidency that went 4 years in a row without a penny's increase to college tuition in my own state. And it wasn't by hoping it so. It was by making it so.
Go ahead, Josh.
So let's talk about how you're positioning yourself in this Democratic nomination race. And why don't we start with a little clip from the debate.
But there is a better way forward than either of those offered by my two opponents here on this stage. We're not going to fix what ails our economy. We're not going to make wages go up for everyone by either trying to replace American capitalism with socialism, which, by the way, the rest of the world is moving away from, nor will we fix it by submitting to sort of Wall Street-directed crony capitalism.
All right. So on the economic front, this race is a choice between crony capitalism, socialism, and a slightly fresher face by the name of O'Malley?
No, it's actually the third part. No, thank you for telling me I have a fresh face.
I said slightly fresher face.
To my face. No, it's a choice between Wall Street crony capitalism, an economy of the few, by the few, for the few, socialism, or fair market American capitalism, where we restore common sense wage and labor policies back to the center of our equation, and we push back against the concentration of corporate wealth and power. Woodrow Wilson said that freedom, economic freedom, also means freedom from monopolies. And right now we have seen a concentration of power, especially when it comes to the big banks, the ones that have given Hillary Clinton money hand over fist in speaking fees, hand over fist in corporate donations, hand over fist in contributions to her family foundation. And she has proven that she does not have the independence to take on the excesses in that concentrated market by being the only candidate on the stage that's not in favor of reinstituting a modern version of Glass-Steagall. And then the third piece of it is we have to make investments in our own country that make our country work. All of those are things that I've done as governor. Those are not things that Bernie Sanders can say that he did. They are not things that Hillary Clinton can say that she did. I am not the candidate of Wall Street, nor am I a socialist. I am a lifelong Democrat. I am the only Democrat seeking our party's nomination. And I defended the highest median income in America through 8 years of the recession, second highest median income for African American families, one of the best states in America for upward economic mobility at a time of stagnant wages. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce named my state number one for innovation and entrepreneurship my last 3 years in office. So I have a track record of actually not only proclaiming political inclusion and doing those actions, but also of practicing economic inclusion that allows my people to give their children lives with greater opportunity. That's the choice.
I mean, do you think Democratic voters haven't looked hard enough at things like Secretary Clinton's speaking fees and the Clinton Foundation? I mean, that's largely been absent lately on the campaign.
Yeah, there's been an effort to limit debates that's totally unprecedented in the history of the Democratic Party. It's the very undemocratic order that Debbie Wasserman Schultz put forward without any support really from the DNC. No vote was ever taken on this to limit debates, and then worse, as an insult to the intelligence and the job that all of you have to do as discerning citizens, to schedule the debates at the times where it's hardest for people to see them. The Republicans had a debate on a weekday. 25 million people on a weeknight, 25 million people tuned in, and then they all talked the next day about the differing views and the choices that their candidates were making for their primary. We held our last debate on a Saturday. Parents that wanted to see the debate had to wrestle the channel changer away from their kids and switch off Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. The last debate we had before that was in Des Moines and was scheduled at the exact same time as the 10-0 football team was playing its game, the exact same time.
I'm not sure Debbie Wasserman Schultz could control their record, but
I don't attribute it to the record. So look, those are the rules. the rules are never really constructed to encourage challengers. But this is little more than a thumb on the scale. The concentration of wealth and power in our economy has also taken place in the Democratic Party. To tell the people of New Hampshire you can only have one debate before you have to make a decision, I think does a disservice to our democracy. So, I don't believe that people have yet. I think that as we come out of the holidays, people are entering that decision-making envelope. And that's a very good thing. And that's what gives me encouragement. I mean, all over New Hampshire, I speak to people who are searching for an alternative, who want to know the differences between us. I have a great deal of respect for Senator Sanders and for Secretary Clinton. But I offer a different candidacy. And I am going to draw those contrasts as clearly as I can. As candidates, we offer. As voters, you, the people, decide. So I'm going to draw the contrasts and then and give the people of our country a choice about their future. We can't be this dissatisfied with a gridlock national politics and an economy that's only working well for a few of us and think that a resort to failed ideologies or divisive politics of the few is going to move us forward. I would never declare Secretary Clinton dead in the first debate, that she's proudest to proclaim that all Republicans are her enemies. I would never have gotten things done as a governor if I declared that all Republicans are my enemies. Passing marriage equality, repealing the death penalty, those things we only accomplished because of some Republican help. Our nation's looking for a new leader, a leader who can bring us together to face our challenges and get things done. That's what I have to offer.
All right, we've got 7 weeks to make that sale in New Hampshire.
Yeah, it's still early. You're right.
You're feeling good about New Hampshire because so far, I know politicians don't like when we talk about polls, but
I'm glad to talk about polls. I'm where John Kerry was at the same time. I'm where Jimmy Carter or other challengers were who emerged on caucus night or the New Hampshire primary. I was out in 1983 for Gary Hart in Iowa, and the media, which has a propensity to focus on only two candidates in either party at a time, understandably. It was all that year, Mondale and Glenn. Mondale was the inevitable front runner, but Hart emerged on caucus night. So I'm running a campaign of ideas. I'm running a campaign on a record of progressive values, progressive accomplishments, bringing people together around some of the toughest issues, like the issues of law enforcement and race in America, issues in our own state that divided other states, like comprehensive gun safety legislation. We got those things done. So we are picking up every day. Who would have imagined that in my own party I have 300% more support than Jeb Bush has today in his party?
Well, in fairness, that party has a lot more candidates to choose from. So, okay, speaking of your prospects here in New Hampshire, as I understand, you're making a big effort in Iowa. But under those weird, funky caucus rules, you have to get a certain percentage point in Iowa before you can even be considered again at those caucuses, which are not an election. Everybody gathers and says, yes, I like him or her. So, Governor O'Malley, you got to reach a certain level in Iowa before you can even be considered. What do you think is going to happen there?
I think I'm going to reach it. I think I'm going to exceed it. And I think I'm going to surprise people on caucus night in Iowa because our country's looking for a new leader. We can't be this dissatisfied with our national economy and our national politics and think that the way forward is to go back.
Well, Governor O'Malley, we know you have another event to attend, and unfortunately you can't stay for our full hour and take some more questions from us and our audience. But thank you for giving us amount of time. Really appreciate it. The Exchange continues
Josh,
in a moment. We will recap this weekend's Democratic debate. Again, Martin O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, former Baltimore mayor, thank you so much for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Thank you all. Thanks a lot.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We just heard from former Maryland governor and Democratic presidential candidate Martin O'Malley. For the rest of the hour, we'll recap the Democratic debate held in New Hampshire on Saturday night, and we'll hear some highlights. Now, in addition to NHPR's Josh Rogers, I'm also joined now by political analyst Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. Dean's also author of the website NH Political. capital.com. And Dean, welcome. Thank you for giving us your time.
Hi, Laura. Happy to be here.
Well, the Democratic debate, Saturday night, right before Christmas. I had to watch it online on Sunday. I was out having fun before Christmas on Saturday night. I'm sure that was the case with a lot of people. We heard Martin O'Malley, Dean, a little frustrated with the whole debate process. Whose idea was it to put New Hampshire's only debate the Saturday night before Christmas?
Well, this is ultimately controlled by the DNC. They said both the DNC and the RNC this time around had decided they wanted to exert a stricter control over the debate schedule. They thought in 2012, the Republicans did that. There were too many debates. Romney took a real beating as a result, and they thought that in some way damaged his candidacy. So we've seen both parties try to clamp down on the number of debates. And I've said a number of times, I don't think you need 20 or 24 debates. You can have fewer debates, but they should be high-profile civic events. And these Democratic debates on Saturday nights, I think the next one is the Saturday or Sunday night of the MLK weekend, which is a big travel weekend for people. I think it's problematic. I've said that before. I agree with Governor O'Malley on that. And there have been pretty high penalties for candidates who engage in other debates. You can be excluded from any subsequent party-sanctioned debate. So, the schedule is what it is. There's been a lot of unhappiness about it. But as you saw, he's just kind of trying to deal with it.
Sure. So big themes from that debate, whether you watched in real time or later online, what were some of the big themes that jumped out at you, Dean?
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting debate. It was a good debate. You saw some real differences on foreign policy, which I think Josh got at in his questions. Secretary Clinton has traditionally been viewed as a bit more hawkish than the other candidates, a little bit more focused on regime change than other candidates. She got some criticism for that. So you saw some differences there. You also saw some differences on domestic policy. Secretary Clinton pledged not to raise taxes on incomes under $250,000. Governor O'Malley and Senator Sanders would not make that same pledge. There was a lot of talk about how you pay for a lot of the domestic programs like free public college or debt-free tuition. So you saw some differences on the economy, some differences on foreign policy. But in the grand scheme of things, compared to what you're seeing in the Republican side, they're all pretty much in the same place. I know Governor O'Malley set up this kind of distinction between crony capitalism and socialism. But in the grand scheme of kind of progressive politics, they're all sort of in the same general area with some differences. And it's been more collegial. And I think you saw, particularly at the beginning of the debate, Governor O'Malley try to get some traction by kind of very aggressively going at the other candidates. And it didn't really resonate because they weren't really bickering. You know, Senator Sanders apologized about the data breach. But he's trying to get traction.
Well, and since you mentioned the foreign policy differences, and I heard those too, Dean, let's hear a little bit from Bernie Sanders. This is, again, Saturday's Democratic debate, and we're going to hear Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders outlining what he said were deep disagreements with Secretary Clinton on regime change, on whether this line that we hear, Assad must go.
And I say this with due respect, that I worry too much that Secretary Clinton is too much into regime change and a little bit too aggressive without knowing what the unintended consequences might be. We could get rid of Saddam Hussein, but that destabilized the entire region. Yes, we could get rid of Gaddafi, a terrible dictator, but that created a vacuum for ISIS. Yes, we could get rid of Assad tomorrow, but that would create another political vacuum that would benefit ISIS. So I think, regime change is easy. Getting rid of dictators is easy. But before you do that, you got to think about what happens the day after.
Again, that's Bernie Sanders at the Saturday night Democratic debate. And Josh Rogers, multiple times during the debate, Bernie Sanders did remind the audience that Secretary Clinton had voted to go into Iraq back in the 2000s. That's an important point for him to make.
Yes, in case people had forgotten that, he's been reminding people of that a lot. And, you know, it is a difference in this race. You heard Governor O'Malley make similar points about, you know, what he believes Secretary Clinton's propensity for being sort of hawkish. And, you know, this is a difference, and this is something. I mean, this was obviously a huge issue back in 2008 when Secretary Clinton was running against then Senator Obama, and, you know, we'll see where it ends up. I mean, you know, Clinton was able to sort of push back at Senator Sanders, suggesting, well, you know, you were on board for you know, Gaddafi, the authorization for that. So, you know, certainly Sanders' foreign policy isn't what he likes to talk about most of the time, and he did seem to be a little bit more comfortable and forceful on that front. I mean, by necessity, it's certainly much more on the minds of voters now than when this race started and during the period in the campaign where he seemed to be picking up steam. I know the Clinton folks think that her experience as Secretary of the State and her expertise, inclinations in terms of regime change and military intervention notwithstanding, is something that is going to be a strength for her. And it's interesting to watch Sanders and O'Malley try to gain traction on something where most voters are more comfortable with Hillary Clinton's expertise, if not every policy decision she's ever made.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, this is really an argument that goes back to the George W. Bush administration, this idea that, you have these strong-armed dictators like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, and you try to bring democracy to other parts of the world, but once you get those dictators out, be careful what you wish for, because the result is often either a leadership vacuum or kind of a fragmentation of different groups vying for power. So that was essentially the argument at the debate was, so you get rid of Assad in Syria, there's going to be a leadership vacuum, and that's going to kind of add to the chaos. And you heard Governor Malley on Saturday say Secretary Clinton was gleeful when Muammar Gaddafi was taken down in Libya, and the result since then has been fairly chaotic. So this has been a debate for some time now, the extent to which we should be involved in trying to foster democratic governments in countries that have largely been ruled by strongmen.
Well, and since you mentioned earlier, Dean, too, there were some differences on economic policy. And we heard Governor O'Malley in our interview saying, well, Bernie, you're a socialist and that's going out of style, he said. And then he called Hillary Clinton a crony capitalist. But at the debate, Dean, and I wonder what you think, Hillary Clinton at one point said, hey, Bernie Sanders, how are you going to pay for, right, you know, the Medicare for all, the free college and so forth? Let's hear what she said.
Now, one of the areas that Senator Sanders touched on in talking about education and certainly talking about health care is his commitment to really changing the systems, free college, a single-payer system for health care. And it's been estimated we're looking at $18 to $20 trillion, about a 40% increase in the federal budget. And I have looked at his proposed plans for health care, for example, and it really does transfer every bit of our health care system, including private health care, to the states to have the states run. And I think we've got to be really thoughtful about how we're going to afford what we propose, which is why everything that I have proposed, I will tell you exactly how I'm going to pay for it, including college.
So what do you hear in that clip, Dean Spiliotis, from Hillary Clinton?
This has been a big criticism of Bernie Sanders. I've had a couple of conversations with Senator Sanders over the last 6 months about how he would fund a number of these programs, particularly the free public education. And his initial response was a response about leading a revolution and throwing Republicans out of Congress. But that's going to be quite a challenge. I think if Democrats have a big year next November, maybe they'll get the Senate back. Not likely to get the House back. It's a very difficult thing given all of the gerrymandering and redistricting in the House. So the question is, how does he deal with a Congress that's going to be pretty significantly to the right of him on a number of these issues? And so he sort of now has kind of gone a little bit deeper and said, well, you know, he's been in Congress for over 20 years and he has leadership skills that will help him to work with members of Congress on these programs. But Hillary Clinton, the flip side is Hillary Clinton is being very careful not to alienate Democratic business elites who have funded her campaign, will likely be strong supporters in a general election. So this is one issue where she's being careful for all of her proposals about debt-free college, et cetera, not to get pulled too far to the left. But this question of how Senator Sanders funds his domestic agenda and how he sells it to a Congress that's not going to be especially cooperative, I think it's the big outstanding question for him, and I'm still not completely convinced he has an answer for that.
Yeah, Josh, how do you hear Hillary Clinton sort of moving to the middle on this?
Well, I mean, you hear the question about essentially how do you define the middle class, and for her it's a threshold of income of $250,000, which is certainly, you know, far in excess of the mean income in these parts or any place else, and obviously New Hampshire has pretty high income. People don't like taxes, though. That's one thing that is clear if you cover elections. And so, House Sanders, I mean, when we had Senator Sanders here, and you could almost tack on to the end of every question, and how are you going to get that done? And Dean is right. That is something that he doesn't have a great answer for. He's been in Congress for a long time, longest serving independent. He doesn't have a great number of bills he can say he passed or that showed these leadership skills that he says he possesses. And, O'Malley, meanwhile, he can point to things he did in Maryland. It was a heavily Democratic state. And, some of what he talked about the improving economic conditions on his watch, some of that actually, has a good deal to do with expanded government spending, during some of the time he was there. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. But, O'Malley's struggling to get in. We saw that in the debate. It was he was a lot more muted this morning in terms of, trying to demonstrate some sort of agency. I think Hillary Clinton probably feels pretty good about where she is. New Hampshire is the place where if Bernie Sanders is going to do something, it's going to be here. And if that can catapult him forward, we'll see.
Well, and you're right, Josh. Governor O'Malley did try during that debate to really distinguish himself from the other two, whether it's, his sort of middle way on the economy and capitalism, or whether it's on guns. And he's tried to make himself be the guy who is more reliable on the gun issue than either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Let's hear.
Senator Sanders voted against the Brady Bill. Senator Sanders voted to give immunity to gun dealers. And Senator Sanders voted against even research dollars to look into this public health issue. Secretary Clinton changes her position on this every election year, it seems, having one position in 2000 and then campaigning against President Obama and saying we don't need federal standards. Look, what we need on this issue is not more polls. We need more principle. When ISIL does training videos that say the easiest way to get a combat assault weapon in the United States of America is at a gun show, then we should all be waking up.
Again, that's Martin O'Malley at the Democratic debate on Saturday night. And Dean Spiliotis, we couldn't play the whole clip, but right. Very soon after, and you watched, Bernie Sanders said, whoa, and Hillary Clinton actually jumped in and said, yeah, come on, Martin, let's talk facts here. So they're both pushing back on this notion that they're not as reliable on guns.
Right.
What do you make of this whole discussion?
Yeah, Senator Sanders often talks about, I think he has a D or a D-minus rating from the NRA, so he's not buying that argument. This is one of those issues where there are just two completely different conversations in the Republican and Democratic Party. Democrats see it as a gun control issue. Republicans, to the extent they're willing to kind of suggest at all that there's a problem, they see it as a mental health issue, not as a gun issue. We had that moment after the horrific Newtown shootings in Connecticut to have some sort of consensus on some even small reforms to our gun laws, and it didn't happen. So I'm not sure what is going to be different going forward. This has largely been a debate within the Democratic Party, but once you take it to Congress, this is one of those issues where NRA is very strong as a lobbying group in Washington. Republican members of Congress are dead set against any kind of further gun control. I mean, they'll talk about it as a mental health issue, but that's really about it. So it's interesting to have this debate, and Democrats seem to have a consensus that something needs to be done on it. But it's a completely different conversation than what we're hearing from Republicans, which leads me to believe there's no easy consensus there going forward for whoever the next president is.
I mean, I think it's interesting to see the extent to which Democrats are aggressively raising this on the campaign trail. Certainly, Hillary Clinton has at several events in New Hampshire. She's done the same in Iowa. It is one of the few topics on which you could say her record is to the left of Senator Sanders. So part of that is that. But, some Democrats really see this as something that could actually help them in a general election, is something that, Democrats don't typically like to talk about guns during a general election. So it's interesting. It's interesting on that front.
Yeah. Well, and again, as Josh reminded Martin O'Malley, not that he needs reminding, just about 7 weeks away before the New Hampshire primary. To you first, Josh, please. So what do these three candidates need to do now in the next 7 weeks before New Hampshire and, of course, the week before that, Iowa?
galvanize the Democratic electorate, make sure that the people that they believe are going to vote for them show up and vote. Obviously, on that front, Governor O'Malley has a steeper challenge than do Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders. It's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, this is a race where people talk about, particularly if you view it through a natural lens, as Hillary Clinton is a really prohibitive frontrunner. That's not necessarily the case here in New Hampshire. This race, according to the polls we have now and how predictive those are, they often aren't at this time of year. But, it's a tight race here, and there's a lot of energy in the Sanders camp. And the Clinton, folks, they know how to run campaigns and win them. And this will be interesting between those two in New Hampshire,
sure.
Certainly. Iowa, I pay less attention to that.
Okay. Dean, how about you? What do you expect over the next couple weeks?
A lot of focus on organization, both in Iowa and here. Senator Sanders needs to win in New Hampshire and figure out some way to turn that into momentum in other states, particularly in the South, where he's not polling nearly as well as he is up here. And Governor Clinton, Secretary Clinton, as we saw on Saturday night, is really already kind of talking to the general election. She really sort of focused on the Republicans, which I think is going to be their strategy. And Governor O'Malley needs to figure out how to break the narrative that this is a two-person race between a progressive candidate on the left and a more establishment-type candidate in the center. And it's not clear where he fits in there. And, I have some sympathy for him. He's basically been running for president really since the 2012 Democratic convention. So he's put a lot of time and effort. He's been here more than either of the other candidates. And to be polling only in single digits, I'm sure he's got to hope that there's some shakeup in the race that we just can't foresee at this point.
Well, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Thank you always for your time, Dean. Really appreciate it.
Sure thing, Laura.
And Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Thank you very much as well.
Anytime, Laura.
Thank you also to our audience who turned out for this special first-in-the-nation primary forum, members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. Again, thank you everyone for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.